OK, thank you. So it's really great to be here. So I'm supposed to give you an overview of the conformal bootstrap. I think there have been a lot of really exciting developments over the last several years for the conformal bootstrap in more than two dimensions, which is a fairly new subject. And I probably won't really have time to do justice to all of the interesting developments that have gone on, but hopefully I can at least set the stage for discussions of the bootstrap going forward into the workshop. And I know several of my collaborators will be here in the next several weeks, and they can fill in some of the details and update you on some more of the latest developments. Of course, the conformal bootstrap is aimed at constraining and hopefully solving conformal field theories. And it's worth just taking a second to ask, why do we care? Why are we interested in studying conformal field theories at all? So to my mind, there are a few reasons. One very basic reason is that conformal field theories are sort of the basic building blocks of quantum field theory. In particular, if you look at just a random quantum field theory, it's probably going to look like a renormalization group flow from a CFT in the UV to a CFT in the IR. Now, sometimes these are trivial CFTs, and sometimes they're interesting interacting CFTs. But that's the basic structure. A second reason is, of course, the ADS-CFT correspondence, which relates conformal field theories in d dimensions to what we think are consistent theories of quantum gravity in d plus 1 dimensions. And I think we basically understand what conformal field theories are. And so this gives us a real window of opportunity to study CFTs, really understand how they're put together in detail. And this can teach us something about how consistent theories of quantum gravity are put together. I think studying CFTs is a really promising way to learn about quantum gravity. Now, a more mundane, down-to-earth reason for studying CFTs is that they show up in the real world. In particular, there are a large number of real physical condensed matter systems where conformal field theories show up, particularly when you look at systems adjusted to be at second-order phase transitions. And there are lots of examples in two dimensions and three dimensions where we have conformal field theories in the real world. One nice example to have in the back of your head is looking at liquid vapor transitions in fluids. And if you take some random fluid and look at its temperature pressure phase diagram, then there's a solid phase, a liquid phase, and a gas phase. The line separating the liquid phase from the gas phase ends at some critical point where there's a second order phase transition. And if you adjust the fluid to be at this critical point, the correlation length goes off to infinity. There's an emergent scale invariance. This is, in fact, seems to be enhanced to a complete conformal invariance. And in lots of real physical fluids, you have a three-dimensional conformal field theory. So this is usually, in many, many fluids, this is identified with a CFT called the 3D icing model, which you can think of as, in field theory language, this is a scalar field in three dimensions with the phi to the fourth interaction, where, of course, its mass is adjusted to zero at the quantum level. One final reason why I think it's interesting to try to learn about CFTs is because they could actually play some interesting role in physics beyond the standard model in four dimensions. There are lots of ideas out there. CFTs could help you understand the hierarchical structure of quark and lepton masses. Conformal dynamics could help explain the hierarchy problem. And so I think there's a real motivation for understanding what four-dimensional CFTs can do, particularly those with no supersymmetry or perhaps n equals 1 supersymmetry. So here's, I think these are all legitimate reasons to be interested in studying conformal field theories. So what I want to do now is basically start with sort of a lightning review of what conformal field theories are, what the basic ingredients are, and eventually how they fit together into the Bootstrap program. And this is probably going to be familiar to many of you, but I think it's worth going over at least briefly. So what is a conformal field theory? Well, it can be characterized by a few things. One thing that it's characterized by is a conformal symmetry. Okay, so this is in d dimensions. This is an SOD, 2 symmetry, or an SOD plus 1, 1 symmetry, depending on whether you're in a Lorentzian or Euclidean signature. The generators can be written down. We have sort of the usual Poincaré generators, translations and rotations. And then in the conformal field theory, you also have the special conformal generators, K mu, and a generator of scale transformations, D. And of course, all these guys fit together in an algebra. So the commutator of P with K gives you D, M, and D, and so on. You can think of P and K as essentially raising and lowering operators in the scaling dimensions of states. Okay, P raises the dimension, K lowers the dimension. And this gives us a nice way to think about the classification of operators in CFDs. Let's see. Good. So one thing that characterizes a CFT is the symmetry. Another thing that characterizes a CFT is a set of local operators. So we can call these O of X. And in fact, we can restrict ourselves to a special set of operators, which are primary operators. So let me add the word primary in here, which are all of the operators that are annihilated by K, the special conformal generator at the origin. Once you have a primary, then you can start acting on it with P. This generates some big set of descendants. And together, the primary operator with all of its descendants form a representation of the conformal group. We can classify operators in terms of, first we can classify representations of the conformal group. The lowest dimension part of that representation is the primary operator. How do we label primary operators? Well, they're labeled by how they transform under the maximal compact subgroup of the conformal group, which is described by the dimension of the operator and how it transforms under the rotation group. They're labeled by the scaling dimension, which is what you get if I take a commutator of D with the operator at the origin. And the Lorentz representation, which is what I get if I take the commutator of M mu nu with the operator at the origin. And if this has some set of Lorentz indices, then we get some matrix appearing here characterizing that representation. And And some, so one nice set of Lorentz representations are the spin L representations. These are traceless symmetric tensors. These exist in any dimension. So this is some nice set of traceless symmetric tensors with L indices. These are called spin L representations. And they're going to be the representations appearing in most of my talk. Of course, it's interesting to know what are the unitary representations. And if you study the constraints from unitarity carefully, you end up with lower bounds on the possible scaling dimensions of the primary operator. Which look like the dimension has to be bigger than d minus 2 over 2 for a scalar, or the dimension has to be bigger than L plus d minus 2 for a spin L operator. So these constraints essentially come from demanding that two-point functions of descendants have a positive coefficient. And those constraints can be studied carefully. So in general, we have a symmetry, we have a set of local primary operators, let's say we know their scaling dimensions and their Lorentz representations. Then we already know a lot. In particular, we know all of the one-point functions and two-point functions in our theory. Once we have this information, we know the one-point and two-point functions. In particular, one-point functions are zero by conformal symmetry. And two-point functions, x1 and x2, are fixed by conformal symmetry in terms of the dimensions and spins, or Lorentz representations. In general, there's some numerator, which is a tensor structure, which you can work out for a given representation. The two-point function is fixed. And you can always work in a basis where the two-point function is diagonalized and has some canonical normalization. So that's completely determined. So the next question is, what happens when you look at three-point functions? It's almost true that the three-point functions are determined by the scaling dimensions and Lorentz representations. Typically, they're determined up to some finite set of overall coefficients. So let's look at three-point functions. Just to be concrete, let's look at a three-point function between a scalar, and some spin L operator. You can carefully study the constraints from conformal symmetry. You find that this is fixed up to some single overall coefficient in terms of the dimensions and spins of the operators. There's some numerator. This is some tensor structure that you can work out. And every other power in the three-point function is fixed in terms of x1, 2 to the 2 delta phi minus delta plus L, x2, 3 to the delta minus L, x1, 3 to the delta minus L. When I write xij, I mean xi minus xj. So this is fixed up to a single overall coefficient. Yes? In this case where you have two scalars in a general spin, Hugh has a number of nice papers that you can look at, but they don't contain every possible case. I guess I had a paper with some people that I can point you to, sort of developing this formalism in an embedding space, which I think is pretty useful for starting to classify all the different tensor structures when you have three different operators of different spins. So I can send you some references. I can post them on the wiki, perfect, yeah. Yes. In this case, the tensor structure is unique. If these are two different scalar operators, it's still unique. And when you start giving all three of these operators different Lorentz representations, then you start having multiple tensor structures. And each tensor structure comes with its own coefficient. What's that? I didn't. Z is some function of the coordinates that you can just write down. I didn't want to write down every single detail, but it's fixed. Yes. Right. This is the translationally invariant and rotationally invariant interval between the points. Yes, if you want to be careful about that's right. So this is fixed up to a coefficient. More generally, you have some finite number of tensor structures, and each comes with its own coefficient. So now, knowing all these three-point functions is equivalent to knowing something else, which is the operator algebra. So in particular, knowing all the three-point function coefficients is equivalent to knowing the OPE. Okay, so in this case, if I look at a product of two scalar operators at different points, this has an operator product expansion where there's some coefficient, which is the same coefficient appearing in the three-point function. There's some function of the separation and derivatives. Acting on O of x2. Okay, so this sum runs over all of the primary operators in the phi cross phi OPE, which is the same as all of the operators which have a non-vanishing three-point function with phi and phi. So what is this function doing? Well, this is a function which basically sums up the contributions from all of the descendants of the primary operator O. And moreover, it's completely fixed by conformal symmetry. So again, this structure is completely determined up to these overall coefficients. So this guy is fixed by conformal symmetry. And once you know the operator algebra, you're basically done. Okay, because you can use the OPE to evaluate essentially any higher point function of local operators in terms of lower point functions. Okay, so in some sense, That's it. You can add the mild caveat that that's it for characterizing all the local CFT data. But you might worry, maybe there's some non-local information that I still haven't captured by this structure. For example, correlation functions involving Wilson lines or Wilson loops may not necessarily be captured by this data. But if you're interested in correlation functions of local CFT operators, you're basically done. And in particular, all other endpoint functions can be evaluated in terms of this, what we will call the local CFT data, which is the dimensions and spins of all of the local primary operators and all of the coefficients appearing in the three-point functions, or equivalently, the coefficients appearing in the OPE. Okay, so we have some set of data, dimensions, Lorentz representations, and three-point function coefficients. Okay, so this is the data that you want to constrain using the constraints of the conformal bootstrap. And so now what we should do is look at a simple example, which is four-point functions of a scalar operator. So now you can say, all right, what are the constraints of conformal symmetry on this object? And you can convince yourself that it depends on some undetermined function of the two conformal cross ratios that you can build out of 4 points. Up to some overall dependence, which looks like a product of two-point functions. This captures the scaling behavior of the four-point function. Here u and v are conformal cross ratios. So it looks like x12 squared, x34 squared, over x13 squared, x24 squared, and a conformally invariant object. V is the same thing with one exchange with three. And now the question is, what is this function? Okay, it's undetermined by conformal symmetry, but it is determined by the operator algebra because we can take this four-point function and plug in the OPE. So what does this do? Well, this gives us an expansion of the four-point function, which looks like this. And up to this prefactor, x12 to the 2 delta phi, x34 to the 2 delta phi, it gives me an expansion in functions. Well, I'm plugging in the OPE twice, so I have two factors of the OPE coefficient. This is why I get a lambda squared, times a function which is called a conformal block or a conformal partial wave. These functions are fixed by the conformal symmetry in terms of the dimension and spin of the exchanged operator. And here you see explicitly, very explicitly, how this four-point function depends on the CFT data. Okay, it depends on the dimension, the spin, and the OPE coefficient. So this is a function called a conformal block. Oh, fantastic. I'm so happy for everybody else. So we can expand four-point functions in conformal blocks. But of course, we started with an object which is symmetric under permutations of all of the coordinates. And when we picked two pairs of operators to plug in the OPE, we sort of broke that permutation symmetry. OK, so this expansion is not manifestly invariant under exchanges of the coordinates. Equivalently, there are other ways we could have done the OPE. So in particular, if you say that this expansion is equal to this expansion, an S channel exchange equals a T channel exchange, you get a very interesting constraint on the CFT data, which looks like what? Well, you get a sum over OPE coefficients squared times conformal blocks in one channel. That's what we had over here. Has to equal, OK, so there's some ratio of the cross ratios, which depends on the external dimension, times the sum over OPE coefficients squared times conformal blocks, where U and V get exchanged. OK, so this is symmetry under exchanging 1 with 3. So this is one of the simplest versions of the constraint that you called crossing symmetry. Okay. Crossing symmetry, which is one of the equations that the conformal bootstrap is interested in studying. And you should really view this as a constraint on the CFT data, which is the set of possible dimensions, spins, and OPE coefficients, because everything else is fixed by the symmetry. OK, so now, OK, so various things you can worry about. You ask, OK, do these expansions actually converge? And in particular, what are the values of U and V when both expansions converge? So you can worry about these issues. And things are generally fine if U and V are between 0 and 1. And so the basic point is that there's an interesting region of this conformal cross ratio space where both of these expansions converge, and this places an interesting constraint. Yes. You're asking if there's so this is the only independent equation. So you can ask what constraint you get from say exchanging 1 with 2. This is 1 with 3. Yeah, so what you learn from exchanging 1 with 2 is that only even spin operators show up in the OPE. But otherwise, it doesn't give you any new constraint.
This is S-channel
equals
T-channel.
Yes. Right, so it turns out that does not give an independent constraint. It would give an independent constraint if we were talking about four-point functions containing different operators. But in this special case where they're all the same, it doesn't give you an independent constraint. Yes. Yes. So you can convince yourself that if crossing symmetry is satisfied for all of the four-point functions in your theory, then it's automatically satisfied for the higher-point functions. So you don't learn anything new assuming that all of the four-point functions of all of the operators in your theory satisfy crossing symmetry. So I guess this should be said. So this is just one constraint. More generally, you have constraints from all of the different four-point functions in your theory. Okay. O, I, O, J, J, O. K, O, L, L, where these can all be different Lorentz, have different Lorentz representations. These can all be different operators. And of course, things start getting very complicated because you have different tensor structures to worry about. As we said, when we look at three-point functions, there are different multiple coefficients which show up. And these constraints start mixing up all of those things. So you get a complicated system, but it's completely well defined. This sum runs over an infinite number of spins. Of this scalar bootstrap? Yes, I think there are an infinite number of solutions to the scalar bootstrap. So I'll show you some of the results from studying this scalar bootstrap equation. And you know, what we can do is explicitly construct in families of solutions with continuous parameters for just the scalar bootstrap. So then an interesting question is, how do these other constraints constrain that space further? But for just the scalar bootstrap, I think there are definitely an infinite number of solutions. Yes. Yeah. This is equivalent to associativity of the OPD. Okay. So now there's one big major issue which I've swept under the rug here, which is that in order to study this equation at all, we need to know what these conformal block functions are. So let me say a little bit about that. Okay, so what are the conformal blocks? So there are various ways to think about them. Of course, there's sort of a brute force way of constructing them by just plugging in the OPE, trying to use what you know about this differential operator. Hugh has some experience in this approach, but this isn't the most fruitful way to think about them. Probably a better way to think about them is that they're nice group theoretic objects because they're eigenfunctions of the quadratic Casimir operator of the conformal group. This is also something that Hugh has developed. So they're eigenfunctions of the SO D, 2 Casimir. Okay, this leads to them satisfying a differential equation, a two-variable differential equation. Some differential operator in U and V acting on G equals the eigenvalue of the Casimir of the exchanged operator O acting on G. So this is a two-variable equation that you can study. You can study it in any space-time dimension. We know how to write down the Casimir as a function of D. And so one statement is that this equation has nice closed-form solutions in even space-time dimensions. So they're nice closed solutions in D equals 2, 4, 6, dot, dot, dot. And there's actually a nice recursion relation relating the conformal blocks in D plus 2 dimensions to the conformal blocks in D dimensions, which you can use to generate these closed form solutions for arbitrary even D. Okay, so this is a nice result by Dolan and Osborne. Okay, what do these solutions look like? Well, it turns out that it's simpler to write these solutions in terms of a slightly different set of variables. In particular, you write U equals Z, Z bar, and V equals 1 minus Z, 1 minus Z bar. And then the solutions can be written in terms of hypergeometric functions of these quantities Z and Z bar. Okay, so just just to give you a feel for what these functions look like, let me write down the solutions in, say, d equals 2. And the conformal blocks of z and z bar look like a product of functions k of delta plus l, k of delta minus l, plus what you get when you exchange z with z bar. Here you can see that there's a nice holomorphic factorization which is going on in two dimensions. This factorization between z and z bar doesn't continue into higher dimensions, so this is some nice feature of two dimensions. And these functions k beta are simply some power, z to the beta over 2, times a 2f1 Gauss hypergeometric function. OK, so this is something very simple that you can write down. You can plug it into Mathematica, play with infinite sums of these functions, and understand various aspects of crossing symmetry. The blocks in four dimensions are almost as simple. So the blocks in four dimensions can also be written in terms of these hypergeometric functions. They just have some prefactor, which depends on z and z bar, breaking this factorization, times k of delta plus l of z, k of delta minus l minus 2 of z bar, minus z goes to z bar. OK, so this is very simple. You can play with this in Mathematica. You can try to make analytical arguments using these sums of these hypergeometric functions, and so on. So one thing that maybe I'll mention is you can ask, you know, what is the analytic structure of these functions? In particular, OK, we have hypergeometric functions. Hypergeometric functions have a branch cut starting at 1. And so if you ask, you know, what is the analytic structure of these blocks in the complex z plane, they have a branch cut starting at 1. OK, and actually, this feature carries over to the blocks in any number of dimensions. OK, so now this lets you do these closed-form solutions let you start to explore the bootstrap in, for example, four dimensions. This is what some of the earliest work on the bootstrap was, because we had these nice, beautiful closed-form solutions. More recently, a lot of the attention has been focusing on studying the bootstrap in three dimensions, or getting away from these even dimensions. So you need some method to calculate the conformal blocks outside of these special cases. And so let me outline what I think the best way is to do that at the present time. So in general, D. OK, so first of all, there's no known closed form solutions. Yes. Yes. It could be extended to that case. And yes, and so the arguments of these hypergeometric functions pick up shifts related to the differences in the external dimensions. So that's completely understood. Life gets trickier when you're talking about external operators with spin, but at least for in two dimensions, sure, yeah, in two dimensions it's understood, but in more than two dimensions, we understand some things, but the story isn't fully worked out. Okay, so in general, D, including the interesting case of D equals 3, no closed form solutions are known. So OK, there have been various attempts to understand how can you calculate these blocks. I think one of the most useful developments came with the introduction of a slightly different coordinate system, which are called radial coordinates. And what are radial coordinates? Well, if I have 4 points, I can do conformal transformations to move these points around in various ways. And the radial coordinates correspond to putting 1 point at 1, 1 point at -1, and having the two other points sort of symmetric around the origin. OK? So this is at a complex location rho. This is at minus rho. And concretely, what is rho? Rho can be related to the z coordinate in a simple way. It's just z over 1 plus the square root of 1 minus z squared. Actually, one of the interesting things that this does is over here in the complex z plane, the conformal blocks are sort of nice, smooth, regular functions everywhere outside of this branch cut. And what this mapping does is it maps this whole region outside of the branch cut to the region inside of a unit circle. Okay, so the boundary of the unit circle is mapped onto this branch cut. Okay, so it sort of squashes all of the interesting region into nice, compact space. And in particular, values of z that aren't too small get mapped onto values of rho that are smaller. Okay, so this is useful for having quickly converging expansions. We can also write this as in terms of r times a phase, r e to the I theta, and try to expand the conformal blocks in general dimensions in terms of these variables. It's not completely obvious. So you have to actually construct these blocks and see them explicitly. But in the region close to one, you can solve this equation explicitly. So in that particular limit, and see that this branch cut structure is there. I'm not sure if there's a good. Well, so I mean, so there is one intuition is that you can ask what configuration of points corresponds to running into this branch cut. And so, if I can have a nice configuration where all 4 points are in a square, for example, then both OPEs converge, and I can start moving the points around. And once they all go into a straight line, then I stop getting into the situation where the OPE has the same convergent properties, and that's precisely running into this branch cut. Right. We're 2 points. Yes. Yes, so you have to be careful about whether you're Euclidean or Lorentzian. In the Euclidean signature, z bar is the complex conjugate of z. In Lorentzian signature, z and z bar are independent real variables. So when you're in Lorentzian signature, you can run into a z branch cut or a z bar branch cut. So you have to be careful when making these arguments about the signature. But I want to tell you how to actually calculate these blocks in general dimensions. You can imagine taking our conformal blocks as functions of r and let me write it in terms of eta, where eta is the cosine of this angle theta. And they have some nice expansion. Where there are coefficients. And these coefficients multiply nice, simple functions of eta, the cosine of this angle, which are Gegenbauer polynomials, times r to the delta plus n. One of the nice things that these radial coordinates do is this angular dependence is very simple. It's just captured by a sum over Gegenbauer polynomials. And each Gegenbauer polynomial corresponds to some descendant of your operator with a definite spin. OK? So this is a nice expansion, both because this angular dependence is simple and because this expansion in R tends to converge fairly quickly in the region of interest. And these coefficients, you can basically solve for them order by order using the Casimir differential equation. OK, so this is one concrete way to do it. Yes, this is just the overall delta. And these j's run over some finite set of spins that are available at a given descendant level. So let me mention one alternate approach that I think is a little more intuitive, and also makes some of the properties of these functions clear. And so one way to think about the blocks is that, I take my four-point function and I insert a complete set of states. So in particular, I have my four-point function. I insert some complete set of states, alpha. Which are normalized in a certain way, normalized to 1. And what do these alphas run over? The alphas run over the primary as well as all of its descendants. So it runs over O, PO, PPO, and so on. So one interesting feature of this is that you have a 1 over the two-point function of alpha in the denominator. And in particular, if alpha is a null state, this blows up. So if you have an operator, if you're looking at an operator whose descendant is in null state, you expect there to be a pole in the conformal block. So this is actually a feature which was used to great effect in two dimensions by Zamolodchikov to write an interesting recursion relation for the 2D conformal blocks as a sum over poles in the exchange dimension. And actually, a similar thing is possible in more than two dimensions. I want to tell you what that looks like. So this has a pole if alpha is a null state. In particular, you expect your conformal block to look like, so there's some coefficient over delta minus delta star. And the residue of this pole is itself a conformal block. The reason is that, if I have a null state, then all of its descendants are also null states. They only transform into each other under conformal transformations. So together, they form a representation of the conformal group. This is a sub representation. So the residue of this pole is itself a conformal block with the dimension and spin corresponding to the null state. So this makes you wonder, maybe I can represent the conformal block in terms of OK, so there's probably some piece without any poles. If you like, this is an entire function, so the only poles of this guy are off at infinity. And then I have some sum over poles in the exchange dimension times conformal blocks corresponding to the sub-representations generated by the null states. Yes? That's a good question. I don't understand if they're the same. Sorry, how did you determine? So first of all, you can see it very explicitly if you know the answer. So that's one thing I can say, right? You can solve, basically, you take this equation, you solve for these coefficients order by order in the R expansion using the Casimir. You see explicitly what these coefficients are. They're always rational functions in the dimension. Can you do which from the differential equation? Oh, determine the analytic properties. As a function of the dimension. Maybe. I'm not completely sure how to make the argument, but it might be possible. So one of the nice things about this representation, once you know it exists, is it makes all the analytic properties clear. So delta k is the delta k plus 2k. So let me just explain the notation here. So the idea is that my primary operator has some special dimension, delta k, where one of its descendants is a null state. Okay, the descendant has dimension delta k plus 2k. That's why there's a shift. Absolutely. So all of these special dimensions violate the unitarity bounds, which is...
These are not the physical dimensions in the exchange diagram.
No, delta is the physical dimension. These delta k's are special unphysical dimensions.
These are not the poles in the...
Correct. Sorry, I understand your question now. Yeah, these are not the same poles. These are not physical poles. These are unphysical poles, but they give a very nice representation for the conformal blocks. I don't know. I would love to see a derivation along those lines. But it's something we've been meaning to understand better. So I don't have a good answer for you. What was that? Probably, but I don't understand the structure in detail. I can tell you what these delta k's look like. And I think, you know, this could be something to discuss more in the workshop, is to understand precisely what these what all these states are.
This formula is not really a when you mean by alpha are not the physical states of the Hilbert space, which of course are normal norm. That's why these poles are not coming from, like, those guys are well defined and can be normalized, right?
Yes. 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 Right.
Okay, but then it's not that alpha is a null state because the notation should be different, O beta.
What was that?
Okay,
yes. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So the idea is that I can imagine taking this exchange dimension and continuing it into this unphysical region, and you expect these poles to show up. And generally, you expect the residues of those poles to be themselves conformal blocks. And this gives you a nice, first of all, a recursion relation that you can use to evaluate the conformal blocks in general dimensions. This guy is a known entire function. And its delta dependence is very simple. It's just proportional to r to the delta. And this means that when I evaluate blocks shifted, this increases the power of r each time I use the recursion relation. And therefore, this is a very efficient way to generate the r expansion. You can write down tables of where these poles are and what these coefficients are. But the upshot is that this is a very efficient way to evaluate the conformal blocks, and it has some interesting analytic structure. I'll mention this representation is in work with David Simmons Duffin and Philip Koss. And this is for external scalars with the same dimension. We've since extended it to external scalars with different dimensions. And I can say a little bit about the applications of that later.
Can you say something about the
table? Yes. Let me just write the table. So there are three sequences of delta k's. And they have different spins. So the spins look like L plus 2k, L and L minus 2k. These are just different ways of adding p's and generating different angular momentum states. And the dimensions look like 1 minus L minus 2k, d over 2 minus k, d plus L minus 1 minus 2k. So these are all, d is the space-time dimension. These are all integers or potentially half integers, integer values of the dimension, where if you look at a two-point function of this dimension, start calculating its descendants, you'll eventually find a null state. The zeros of the matrix, including all the descendants? Yeah, probably. Let me try to remember. I'd have to double check. I think the poles stay the same, but the coefficients change. Yeah, that's right. The poles don't change, but all these coefficients do change. Yeah. Oh well. This is different than two dimensions. Yeah, this is not Virasoro at all. Yeah, so in two dimensions, your discussion should involve the Virasoro group and so on.
You still get null states.
Yeah. Yes. Good. Oh, well, so it depends on how precisely you need to know the blocks. In what we're doing, typically we're expanding this to, say, 40, r to the 40th power. up to 40th order. But it's easy. You just write down a mathematical function that does this recursion relation and evaluate it a bunch of times. This list is complete, yes. Yes. Yes, yeah, so for example, you can verify that this expression satisfies the Casimir differential equation to all orders. Okay, so now let's talk about the bootstrap. Okay, so there are various approaches to the bootstrap. I guess you could classify them according to analytical approaches or numerical approaches. I think probably some of the most interesting results recently have come from numerical studies of the bootstrap program. Maybe I'll briefly mention some of the analytical progress that's been made. It sort of falls into a few simple categories. So of course, in two dimensions, a lot of analytical progress was made in the bootstrap, in particular, making use of the Virasoro symmetry. So that's old news. There's been some analytical progress at studying these bootstrap constraints in large N theories. Okay, so there's one. This is one limit. If I start with an infinite n solution that I understand, I can expand around it systematically in a 1 over n expansion and try to solve the bootstrap constraints. So some progress has been made in this direction. Another direction where analytical progress has been made is what you might call a large L. Okay. where if you study the bootstrap constraints in an iconal type limit, so a limit where two of the points are light-like separated from each other, this corresponds to U, for example, taking U to be very, very small while holding V fixed, you can make some analytical progress in this limit where you can learn something about the large L spectrum of a general CFD. So maybe I'll don't go into this. So just briefly, if I go to this small u limit, what happens in the crossing relation is that on one side I have, let's say, the unit operator, and I have a sum over OPE coefficient squared times u to the power of the twist over 2. The twist is what dominates in this iconal limit, times some functions, which are regular at u goes to 0. And so, okay, the leading twist operators dominate in this limit on one side. And on the other side of the crossing relation, you have something like 1 plus a sum over coefficient squared times v to the twist over 2 times these same functions. And on one side of the crossing relation, the leading twist operators dominate. On the other side of the crossing relation, you can understand that these leading twist contributions have to be matched by the sum over spins. In particular, you have to go to the asymptotic behavior at large spins. You need an infinite sum in order to reproduce, for example, this unit operator contribution. And you can make some arguments about what that asymptotic behavior at large spin has to look like. So in particular, you can, for example, argue that in order to reproduce this unit operator singularity, you need a sequence of operators on the right-hand side where the twists, so this means they need a sequence where the twists, tau as a function of L, approach 2 delta phi, approach 2 delta phi. Okay. And actually, if you start looking at, this is sort of generating the leading contribution. If you go in the small, the limit where v is also somewhat small, if you go to add more orders in v, you see that this has to be extended to 2 delta phi plus integers. And so you need sequences of operators whose twists approach 2 delta phi plus integers in order for this to possibly work. And you can go a little bit further. So this is in the large L limit. You can also then start looking at the leading corrections to this in something like a 1 over L expansion and see that this has to get corrected by some coefficient times L to a power. And what is this power? This power can get related to the leading twist operator on the left-hand side of the crossing relation. And the coefficient can also be related to the OPE coefficient of the leading twist operator on the left-hand side. So you can make some progress. Yes, and they're spinning very, very rapidly around each other. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good intuition.
And that tau star is just whatever is the leading thing that can exchange in the bulk. The lightest.
Yes. That's right. So in particular, in a lot of theories, the leading twist operator on the left-hand side is the stress energy tensor, where the twist is two. D minus 2. And then because this coefficient can be related to the OPE coefficient of the stress energy tensor, you can actually write it in terms of the central charge of your CFT. So there's a lot of interesting information contained in this large spin sector of a CFT, which you can understand analytically from the bootstrap. Let me... Yes. Yeah. This OPE coefficient for the central charge is proportional to delta phi squared over C. And there's also been, I should mention, there's also been some interesting recent analytical progress in the bootstrap in four-dimensional theories with extended supersymmetry. So there's an interesting recent paper by Leonardo Rastelli and collaborators. There have also been some interesting arguments by Alday and Busey, and so on. So there's been a little, some interesting progress in 4D, n equals 2, and 4 theories analytically. But now I want to focus on what we can learn from numerical studies of the bootstrap. And there's been a large number of interesting results. Most of these results come in the form of studying the bootstrap conditions and using them to place bounds on the allowed values of dimensions and OPE coefficients. Okay. And the first work along this line was Rotazzi, Richkoff, Tony, and Vicky, around 2008. So what is the basic strategy for finding bounds on operator dimensions from the bootstrap? Well, the basic idea is to, first of all, make some assumption about the spectrum that you're trying to test. Okay, so let's make an assumption. For example, all scalar operators have a dimension larger than some minimum dimension. You put in a gap into the spectrum. The approach that's been used in most of the work is to take this assumption and then try to prove a contradiction by which you could rule out that assumption. The way to try to prove a contradiction is, well, one way to do it is to apply some linear functional to the crossing relation. So apply a functional. Alpha, which takes a function of two variables to a real number. And now if I write the crossing relation like 1 equals a sum over OPE coefficient squared times, say, functions of u and v, I can apply some functional to this. And if I can find a functional such that alpha acting on all these functions f is positive, or possibly greater than or equal to 0, whereas alpha acting on the unit operator contribution is negative, then I get negative number equals a sum over positive numbers, and I have a contradiction. So this argument is very explicitly making use of unitarity. So in particular, the fact that these coefficients squared are positive, the lambdas are real numbers. But now if you can find some functional which satisfies these positivity constraints, then you prove a contradiction, and you can rule out your assumption about the spectrum. So okay, so what do these functionals look like? Well, one simple basis is to take, say, linear combinations of derivatives of these functions evaluated at some point. Okay, this is what's been done in most of the studies so far. So I can say alpha is some sum over derivatives with respect to the cross ratios. Here I'll write it in terms of z and z bar, evaluated at some particular point. And most of the studies in the literature have been at the most symmetric point, which is z equals z bar equals 1/2. Okay, so, and I can take, if I want to make this into a finite problem that I can give to a computer, I can take derivatives up to some finite order. I should probably wrap up soon, huh? Yeah. Except I won't be here next week. That's the problem. So, so that makes it difficult. So, but if I could have, you know, 10 more minutes. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Good. So this leads to, I can apply this functional. This leads to a large number of linear constraints. Okay. So I have linear inequalities. I have some that I want to find a solution to. This is a problem you can give to a computer. And so I get some large number of linear constraints. Which leads to something called a linear programming problem. So I get a large, yeah, so if I take the crossing relation and I Taylor expand it, at every order in that Taylor expansion, I get some constraint. So So if I just take the crossing relation and Taylor expand it and read off the different coefficients, then I get a bunch of equalities. But now we're trying to prove some contradiction, so we can rule out an assumption about the spectrum. So in order to find a contradiction, we want to find linear combinations of these equalities which satisfy certain positivity properties. So that's what we're telling the computer to do in what's called a linear programming problem. One thing that's tricky about this is that here we want this to be positive, so this has some label which depends on the dimension of the exchanged operator, and we want this to be positive for all values of delta subject to our assumptions. This is an infinite number of constraints, and so you have to deal with that infinity somehow. So one approach is to just discretize the set of dimensions that you impose positivity on. This leads to a linear programming problem. The other approach is to make use of an interesting feature of these functions, which is that they can be very well approximated by rational functions in the exchange dimension. This follows from this expression for the conformal blocks as a sum over poles. So there's a nice way to represent them in terms of rational functions. So this is one approach. The other approach is to use that alpha of f can be approximated by some numerator over denominator, where the numerator is a polynomial in the exchange dimension, and the denominator is some positive function. And so all these constraints can be rephrased in terms of inequalities involving polynomials. And there's a nice way to capture inequalities involving polynomials, which is to represent them in terms of positive semi-definite matrices. And this leads to an approach which is called semi-definite programming. So the advantage of this approach is that you don't have to discretize this gigantic set of dimensions. You can capture these constraints all at once. The disadvantage is that semi-definite programs are harder than linear programs. So there's a trade-off here, but this has actually turned out to be a very efficient way of solving this problem. Right, we're trying to be agnostic about the lambdas other than the fact that the square is positive. Exactly. At this level, yes, but we can act. I'll try to show you ways we can recover it. So let me just. I need to show you results. this gives us a general strategy for finding bounds on operator dimensions, for example. And so what do those bounds look like? Well. There were a lot of studies in four dimensions. Some of the most interesting recent results have been in three dimensions. So let me start there. And what are we plotting? Well, we can place a bound. Let's say my external operator is phi. We can place an upper bound on the dimension of the phi squared operator as a function of the dimension of phi. Phi squared is the first non-trivial scalar appearing in the phi phi OPE. So what does this bound look like? Well, a free scalar has a dimension of 1/2, and the dimension of phi squared is 1. So this is the origin of my plot. And you can place a non-trivial upper bound on the allowed dimension of phi squared, which looks something like this. So all the region above this curve is ruled out. And what do you see? Well, first of all, there's a very non-trivial upper bound. And moreover, it has some interesting feature in it. This is what I want to highlight. There's basically a discontinuity in the shape of this bound, which is carved out by crossing symmetry and unitarity. So what does this feature correspond to? Well, OK, so you can look up, figure out where it is. This is at 0.518. This is 1.41. And you think about these numbers, and you realize this is almost precisely where the dimensions in the three-dimensional Ising model sit. So this is a spectacular result. We put in nothing about the theory, other than we have a CFT with crossing symmetry and unitarity, and we have some scalar operator. And we find a feature which seems to correspond to the 3D Ising model. So this is completely unexpected. Is there any analytic way? Yes. So good. So I hid this a little bit, but we can. You know, we're Taylor expanding up to some finite order. As you go to higher order, you can get a stronger and stronger bound. So actually what you find is some sequence of bounds which looks like this. And they've been pushed to the point where they seem to be pretty well converged. So I don't know of an analytic way to know that we have the best possible bound, but at least we can do, you know, numerical studies of how well this sequence has converged. And actually, it better have converged pretty well because, you know, if you zoom in on this point, you know, we have a curve like this. It's not completely a kink. It has some curvature if you zoom in enough. But you can also look at what's known about the dimensions in the 3D icing model, and there's some box with error bars, and our bound goes right through that box. So it really can't get much better if the existing determinations of dimensions are accurate. I think that's numerical precision. I think if you push this to an infinite order Taylor expansion, that this would probably become sharp. What's that? It would become sharp, a sharp discontinuity. Two functions. I don't want to make any strong claims about what the shape would look like. So that's very exciting. It's actually, what's that? It becomes more cuspy as you increase the precision. Yes. So this is actually very reminiscent of what happens if you do this plot in two dimensions. So we can redo this whole procedure in two dimensions, put in nothing about Virasoro symmetry, just the global 2D group. And also compute a bound, and you see a similar structure with a kink in it. And this kink in two dimensions occurs at 1/8 and 1, which is precisely where the 2D icing model sits. This is from these numerical studies. Completely, yeah, and they were making heavy use of Virasoro symmetry and so on. So here we're not. Here I'm not putting any of that. In part because we want to understand how this extends to higher dimensions. But you can locate the 2D icing model again as some discontinuity in this bound. And moreover, in 2D you can also locate the other minimal models, and the other minimal models seem to have operators which sit right along this curve. That's a good question. So this is crossing symmetry on the sphere that we put in so far. So you ask, what more do you need to put in? What's that? Right. So, sure. So you know, once you start putting in more of these constraints, you'll see that, you know, these are just a discrete set, and that there aren't theories between them. But we can't distinguish that right now. What's that? Not in the way that I just described. But I expect that's what would happen. So there are a few other things I can put on here. So first of all, there's a line here which corresponds to a free boson in 2D. Okay, you can look at a vertex operator with some parameter alpha. This corresponds to some line. This actually asymptotes to that line. And the minimal models also have some other operators which you can identify which sit down here, which don't seem to be saturating this curve. So not every OPE saturates this sort of bound, but there's at least some sequence which does. Yeah. Good. So let me say that next. You can, because we can calculate the conformal blocks in any dimension, okay, as a function of d, we can continue this bootstrap to fractional dimensions. So this is a study we did recently. And you can actually look at the interpolation of this curve from 2 dimensions to 3 dimensions to 4 dimensions. So if I plot, for example, the anomalous dimension, so the difference between the dimension of phi and its free value, and the dimension of phi squared and its free value, then in 4D, for example, you have a free scalar. Okay, so I have some thing here. And in 2D, I'll be up at 1/8 and 1. So I have some bound in 2D. You can continue this to different dimensions. It interpolates to 3 dimensions, and then you go down to 4, and eventually the location of this kink approaches the origin as you approach 4 dimensions. 3.5, 3.8, it approaches the origin, so these lie along some nice curve. And the location of this kink can actually be matched very, very well to the calculations in the epsilon expansion as you go to this point. It works very beautifully. In most of this region, you can do a matching to calculations in a Borel resummed epsilon expansion, and even that works pretty well. So it seems to be something real. I really should stop soon, but let me just mention one more application, which is that these bounds can be extended to theories with ON global symmetry. So what does that involve? Well, we're looking at 4-point functions of some operator phi, which is in the vector representation of ON. The phi OPE can be extended in terms of different ON representations. So you have a sum over singlets, symmetric tensors, and anti-symmetric tensors, for example. So there's some sum over these. And then you can plug in this OPE, study the resulting system of crossing relations you get. This can be extended in different tensor structures. Sitting in front of each tensor structure is some crossing relation. And then you can bound each of these representations independently. So if we do this for the ON singlets, you again get some sequence of curves like that. So we can call this O2, O3, O4, O5, dot, 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 up till, and we can do this at large n, so we went up to O20 at the end to try to understand the structure. And now you can ask, how does this compare to what's known about both the O2 model, the O3 model, and so on. There's lattice data and experimental data. And also, you can compare to the large N calculations when you get up to this point. In basically every case that we've checked, the matching of the location of this kink works very nicely. In particular, the dimensions in the O2 model are known very well. So there's some little x with small error bars that you can draw here. O3 model is known pretty well. You start getting bigger error bars when you go to O4 and O5, and then information starts petering off. But you can also then compare this to calculations in the 1 over n expansion and see that, for example, comparing to the O20 model, the 1 over n calculations get this very precisely. So it all seems to work very beautifully. There's a deep structure here. Crossing symmetry somehow knows about the O(n) vector models. It knows about the 3D icing model. It knows about this whole family of fixed points that interpolates between two dimensions, three dimensions, and four dimensions. And of course, the big question is why? What is the deeper structure here? So this is something that we're trying very hard to figure out. And one way we're trying to figure that out is to basically go to this boundary and reconstruct more of the spectrum and understand how do you characterize this transition. Okay, so for example, if I go to this curve and start from the left of it and cross it going to the right, there seems to be some interesting transition in the spectrum of operator dimensions. Operator dimensions move around. You might characterize this as a phase transition in operator dimension space. Sorry, good. So one other thing that I can say is that if you go to this boundary, it's possible to reconstruct the solution to crossing symmetry corresponding to theories living on the boundary. So let me tell you one way that this is possible. So I told you we're applying these functionals to this crossing relation. The bound corresponds to alpha on the unit operator changing from being positive to being negative. And so right along the boundary, it's 0. So for solutions on the boundary, I have a relation which looks like 0 equals a sum over lambda squared alpha of f, which depends on the dimension. And how can this be true? The only way that this can be true is if lambda 0 or alpha of f is 0. So now I take the functional that my program spits out, I plot alpha of f, and look for where it has zeros. Okay, these are the only values of the dimension where the OPE coefficients can be non-zero. So this is one very concrete way that you can, you know, you plot alpha of f, you see some discrete set of zeros as a function of delta. And this picks out the possible spectrum of a solution to cross symmetry. And then you can go back and plug in the spectrum and solve for the OPE coefficients. So there's a systematic way to reconstruct the spectrum of a theory which lives on the boundary. This is one way of doing it. There's actually another way we're also developing right now, which tries to solve crossing symmetry more directly. This is sort of an indirect way by applying functionals. You can also just try to directly solve it and tell a computer to do that. Yes? Probably not. So this is a procedure to construct a solution to the single scalar crossing relation. So there's absolutely no guarantee that you have a full CFT. This is a particular basis of alphas and. Right. So this is something that probably should be explored more. So we played around with expanding around different points, trying to use different bases for these functions. The one that I explained to you seems to be the most efficient one, and so far everything that we tried has basically given the same answer. But there's definitely room for someone to come along and come up with some very clever basis for functionals. Maybe even to make analytic arguments, where the story could be understood better. Yeah, so this is something we're mapping out right now. So you ask what happens at the kink. There seems to be a reshuffling of the operator spectrum. Certain operators. Right. So I don't want to reveal too much because I think my collaborators will be here in a couple weeks and they'll say more of this story. But there's an interesting rearrangement of the spectrum. In 2D, you see the same thing, and there you can sort of interpret this you know, there's a decoupling of operators right at this point corresponding to null states appearing in the spectrum. And I think a big question is whether something similar happens in 3D, which it looks like it may be plausible. So this is something we're trying to understand right now. Right, so for example, in this interpolation, the location of the cusp goes to the free value. And more than? Well, no, I think you can get bounds in the same way in more than four dimensions. You just. Oh, no, there are CFTs. Lots of CFTs have scalar operators in them. 5D CFTs have scalar operators in them. Close to the free scalar value. Yeah, well, I don't know the full space of CFTs in more than four dimensions, but. Well, the free scalar solution exists in any dimension. In 4 plus epsilon, that's right. Sure. I'm not sure what information you'd have to put in to rule out solutions in 4 plus epsilon near the free solution. It's a good question. And six. Sure. This is a study that could be done. I mean, I think there's a lot of open directions pushing it to higher dimensions. We've done some studies involving supersymmetry, for example, but there's more than that can be done. So I didn't have a chance to mention this. Probably none. Yeah. I guess I'm not. I'm not sure if it would show up in a single scalar four-point function or not. I guess I'd have to think about it. I can say one other direction that's sort of in progress is, you know, one obvious thing you want to do here is, here we have four-point functions of some single scalar or maybe a scalar in an ON. Or a global symmetry representation, you'd really like to extend this to four-point function containing different operators. So, for example, phi squared. So one study we have in progress is to look at this kind of system of operators and to try to understand how does this system of crossing relations further constrain the allowed space. And so, for example, in the context of the 3D icing model, one thing that this does is it, first of all, gives you access to the Z2 odd operators in the spectrum. This is not something you have access to with four-point functions of the sigma field. And then the other question is how does this further constrain the space? In particular, can you start to rule out any solutions away from this point? And I think this is still an open question. So maybe that's a good place to stop. So, what I can say, I mean, there seems to be a transition happening at this point. So I think we're still trying to understand the best way to characterize that transition. And as I said, in two dimensions, this transition has a nice characterization. It corresponds to null states or degenerate representations of the Virasoro group showing up, which is why you have operators decoupling at these special dimensions. I think an important question is whether you have some similar characterization in more than two dimensions. And so I don't have a complete answer for you, but that's what we're currently trying to understand. Constraining lambdas. Yep. So in a very similar way, you can place bounds on the OPE coefficients. And so this has been done in various cases. So, you know, in 3D, you can place bounds on the sigma, the phi, phi, phi squared OPE coefficient, sigma, sigma, epsilon. Another interesting case is you can place a bound on the OPE coefficient sitting in front of the stress tensor, which, as I mentioned before, can be related to the central charge of the CFT. Good. So, the OPE coefficient of the stress tensor looks like delta phi squared over C, T mu nu. This is the coefficient. We can place an upper bound on this coefficient, which translates into a lower bound on C. And if you plot that in 3D, what do you see? So let me plot C divided by the central charge of a free scalar. So at 1/2, this is B1. And the bound has some shape like that. Okay, where this, what seems to be a minimum, occurs right around the dimension of the icing model. So I can say, so there's a couple things here. So first of all, the central charge in the 3D icing model is not known. No one's calculated this yet. It looks very plausible that the central charge sits at a minimum in this plot. So a natural conjecture is that the central charge of the 3D icing model has the smallest central charge of all possible 3D CFTs. Another thing that I can say is that more generally, if you go look at the solutions along this boundary and reconstruct their spectrum, then the central charge of that solution also corresponds to this bound. So more generally, there's some principle of C minimization at play here. So at least if you look at solutions along the boundary, the central charge seems to take its minimum value possible. So I think that's an interesting feature and maybe one way to characterize why these solutions are special. In the 2D case. I don't think so. I'd have to remind myself what studies of the central charge in 2D have been done. But I don't think you see that here. I think one reason why going to these correlators with different operators of them is important is that it could help you distinguish between all these different solutions. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure what insights you get from these studies about RG flows. Thank you.